David Ezrati, 47 years old. It's April 22nd, 2010. We're in Dayton, Ohio, and I'm going to be interviewing my father, so I am his son.
Stephen Ezrati, 83, April 22, 2010, Dayton, Ohio, and I am his father.
So, start out at the beginning. Where were you born?
Berlin, Germany.
What year?
1927.
And your parents were pretty affluent. Can you tell me, you know, what their social standing was?
They were wealthy. My father was a physician. He had a car, which was unusual at the time in Germany. It was a 1932 Buick, and it had been given to him by a patient.
In 1932?
Yeah, no, in 33.
In 33, okay. Yeah. But 33, you were born at in 27, and 33 was a significant year for a number of reasons, but what happened for you?
Well, what happened to me was that Hitler came to power, and the first thing that happened was I got thrown out of school because all Jewish children had to be separated from the school system. And then my father took off and went to Palestine, and we followed. My mother and I followed about 2 months later after my mother had auctioned off the contents of our apartment.
And there was an interesting story about how your father made his way from back and forth between Berlin and...
Well, this depends on whose version you have. According to my father, he was buddy-buddy with a guy whose name was Milch, who ended up as the commanding officer of the Luftwaffe. And... my father had done aeronautical research or medical research in aviation to do with flying ambulances and evacuation of people from disaster areas and things like that. And he was a friend of Milch's. And according to my father, Milch flew him out of Germany and into France, whence my father took a ship and went to Palestine. That may not be true. We don't know. My father had a tendency to exaggerate or aggrandize himself or make himself more important than he was.
Does that run in the family?
Maybe.
So, he got out of Germany, got you out of Germany, got my grandmother out of Germany.
And right.
I never got to meet him because he died in 1959 before I was born. But the rest of the family stayed in Germany with the exception of later on, he went back. And
well, he went back a peculiar way. He had a Palestinian passport. He was a British subject and a Palestinian citizen. And he went to Switzerland from the United States. And there was a place in Switzerland where a restaurant had its back door in Germany and its front door in Switzerland. And he knew this because he had been in that area previously. And so he went into Germany illegally through this restaurant and went to Berlin, where, among other things, he spoke to the American consul and begged for immigration visa to the United States for my grandmother, my aunt, and my cousin. The consul's comment was, you know, doctor, you're the first person I've ever seen who wants to be with his mother-in-law. be that as it may, he did not get my grandmother out. He did manage to get papers from my aunt and my cousin, who arrived in New York in 1939.
So there was a span of time between 33 and 39. Where were you from there to?
From September of 33 to May of 37. I was in Tel Aviv going to school up to the fourth grade, and I got thrown out of the fourth grade.
Why'd you get thrown out of the fourth grade?
They assigned us some Talmud homework. This was a puzzle. You have a farm, and your neighbor has a farm, and his dog comes across the fence and kills your chicken. And before the chicken dies, it lays an egg. And the question for you to solve, and this, remember, this is fourth grade, mm-hmm. is who owns the egg? And I came home in tears and asked my mother to help me. My mother called a friend who was a Bible scholar, and he threw up his hands and he said, "This is the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen." Refused to answer it. So I went back to school the next day and refused to answer it, whereupon I got thrown out of school. The Tel Aviv public schools insisted on orthodoxy as the only way to live.
So did, when you got thrown out of school, was that the impetus to leave the country and come here? Or
no, my father was already out.
Okay.
He was in the United States in pursuit of a Guggenheim Fellowship in aviation medicine. But that may have been as phony as some of the other things about him, and I have no way of knowing if that was true.
So when did you come over?
We arrived in New York on May 20, 1937.
Okay. And in New York, you had to learn a new language, and you had to make new friends. This is your third language.
Right, and my third alphabet.
Third alphabet. That always makes it easy. So you were in New York for how long?
Not very. We arrived in May. In the summer, we went to a camp in Maine where my mother was the camp nurse. Then we came home and immediately moved to Boston, where my father was supposed to be superintendent of a convalescent home and my mother was the nurse. But the place wouldn't allow me to live there, so I had to be farmed out to some other people. And I lived with them for a year in Everett, Massachusetts.
And that was that wasn't any fun. But
no.
let's go on. World War II starts.
I tried to enlist.
And how old?
My first enlistment attempt was in the Air Force. So I went down to the former Cadillac building on Commonwealth Avenue in Boston and tried to enlist in the Air Force, and they said, "You have not been a citizen of an allied country for 10 years because we were naturalized as British subjects in 1935, and this was 1941, I guess, and that wasn't long enough. So then I tried the Navy, and the Navy told me that my leg would prevent me from walking from one end of the ship to the other. So then I got drafted, and I ended up in the infantry, and I walked from here to eternity.
And you got over to Europe just as the war had...
No, the war had already ended when I got to Europe, and I spent my European time in Venezia Giulia on the border with Yugoslavia. We were holding the Morgan Line, which separated a partition of Venezia Giulia between the two countries.
And you were, that's where you learned German again?
I learned it from a POW. the guy's name was Hans Müller. And when I came home, I said to my mother, "Hey, you know, I met a guy in Italy whose name was Hans Müller, and he was a patient of my father's. Do you know him?" She said, "Do you know John Smith?"
So when did you start feeling Zionistic tendencies? When was, I mean, you'd left Palestine because you didn't like the...
Oh, no. I didn't leave Palestine voluntarily. I left it very involuntarily. I wanted to stay there.
Okay.
And there was an American family called Kaplan that offered to let me stay with them. And my mother wouldn't allow it, and she insisted on dragging me to the States. I went to a party in Trieste run by deserters from the Jewish Brigade and met a couple of people I knew as a child and got involved in illegal immigration. And that was the beginning of my Zionist activity.
Illegal immigration, explain that.
Well, the British controlled Palestine and placed a limit on the number of Jews allowed to come in. And what these people were doing was smuggling survivors of the Holocaust into Palestine. And they were illegal immigrants to Palestine under the British view. I didn't actually do very much. I just directed some traffic.
And when was this? This was
1945 and 46.
Okay. And so you came back from Europe when?
In December of 1946.
And what did you...
And I joined Beitar, which was a Zionist youth organization that was backing the revolt of the Irgun Zvi Lumi. And... It was a militaristic organization, male and female. We wore uniforms to all meetings, and we demonstrated in uniform. And through Beitar, I eventually ended up being the commander of the Irgun in Boston.
And some people would describe the Irgun as terrorists, especially the British.
Yes.
Okay, so there's...
Well, they did a lot of things that would be considered terrorist in the terminology we use today. They blew up the headquarters of the British Army in Palestine at the King David Hotel in Jerusalem. When the British hanged some of our guys, the Irgun kidnapped some British soldiers and hanged them. When they whipped some of our people, they whipped some Englishmen. It was a tit-for-tat organization that believed in an eye for an eye.
And how did you keep track of what was going on in Palestine at the time? How were you staying informed?
Mainly through the New York Times and a little bit by shortwave radio. I was a shortwave listener, and I listened to, believe it or not, the best news of what was happening in Palestine came from a station in the Belgian Congo.
So what made you decide that you wanted to go back? I mean, right at this point, you started in college, right?
Yeah.
You started at Boston University and working on a political science degree.
Right.
Were you driving a cab already?
No.
No. Okay. So what made you decide that you sort of wanted to go over to Israel or Palestine at the time, and did you know the consequences of that action?
In the early part of 1948, we received an order from Menachem Begin, who was later Prime Minister of Israel, but he was the commander of the Irgun, and it was a call to the colors and asked all members of Beitar to come to Palestine to fight. And I signed up right away.
And who were you supposed to fight?
The British.
Okay.
It turned out that I never got there. And
wasn't there some rules about going to Palestine for American citizens at the time?
President Truman had invoked the Neutrality Act, which required that Americans not travel in the Middle East. And I told the State Department I was going to the Union of South Africa and got on the ship, headed for Haifa. And they later questioned me why I told them I was going to South Africa when I went instead to the Middle East.
And when your answer was?
I didn't answer them because under a lawyer's advice, they would have caught me for perjury.
Right. Okay, so what happened on that trip?
Well, the ship was due in Beirut, Lebanon, on the day after Israel had declared its independence. And we tried to get the American export line to change the course of the ship and dock in Haifa first, expecting trouble in Beirut. American export lines refused. We docked in Beirut. A bunch of American Army 6x6 vehicles pulled up on the dock. An Army lieutenant came aboard, and he demanded all of us who were headed for Haifa were to get off and get in the trucks. We spent about a half a day arguing in Beirut with the American consul, who was a Dixiecrat from Spartanburg, South Carolina, doing his utmost to make us feel miserable. He called us names, insulted us, told us we were a bunch of terrorists, etc., etc. Nice guy.
Yeah.
His name was John B. Faust.
Okay. And then what happened?
Well, we spent 6 weeks as prisoners in Baalbek, up in the mountains of Lebanon. I was the first American hostage in Lebanon because I was the first person off the ship.
Okay, so who was holding you?
The Lebanese army.
Okay.
And after 6 weeks, they gave up and let us come back.
So you never made it to Israel?
Never made it to Israel because the ship that we were on, we were put on, was headed back to New York. The ship had a very strange itinerary. It was going from Beirut to Alexandria in Egypt, from Alexandria to Palermo in Sicily, from Palermo to Naples in Italy, and then from there to Ponta Delgada in the Azores. And at each stop except Alexandria, members of our contingent managed to walk off the ship somehow. We got a message to jump ship in the Azores, where we would be met by an airgun ship, and we were, but we were caught by the Portuguese police, put aboard the sister ship of our ship, and sent directly back to the States and kept in the brig most of the time.
So
when we got to New York, they took away our passports.
And when did you get it back?
About 7 years later.
So there was something you had said to me about this whole experience, and you said this was probably the time you were most afraid in your life.
Yes, and actually the most afraid part was on the trip back from the prison to Beirut in a bus going downhill at 70 or 80 miles an hour around S-curves. And we never thought we were going to make it.
So you got back to the States with no passport.
Right.
And you went back to school. You still hadn't finished your undergrad, right?
Right.
And when did you start driving a taxi?
Well, there's a big gap here. I was, as an undergrad, I was in ROTC.
Right.
And in my second year, they called me into the colonel's office and threw me out of ROTC with the reason that I lacked leadership qualities. I appealed this. I went all the way down to Governor's Island in New York to First Army headquarters and talked to somebody. And I was surprised that they threw me into the G2 section for this. G2 is intelligence. And I got suspicious, and eventually it turned out that they had me as a communist or something. And it doesn't make any sense.
I remember when I was growing up, at one point you had finally got your Freedom of Information Act pile of documents, and it's pretty tall.
Still have it.
Still have it, and they'd redacted a lot of names and everything else. So the American government had been keeping tabs on you from when to when, do you think?
From about 1946.
Until
I finally left the United States in 1954 and went to Israel, where I married your mother.
Boy.
Can I ask, what motivated you to make this trip originally and to take all these risks and go through all these experiences? What was it that made you decide to embark on such a dangerous journey?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand.
Why'd you do it? Why'd you?
Well, I wanted to be in Israel.
You wanted to be in Israel?
Yes.
I mean, Israel was a new thing.
Right. Well, even before that, I was never comfortable being in the United States. I felt myself an alien here. I was terribly, terribly teased as a kid because of my German accent. They called me Hess in the eighth grade.
Oh, that's not too far off of what you were born, because you weren't born Stephen Ezrati.
No, I was born Stefan Halman Hirsch.
And you changed your name?
When we became Palestinian citizens.
And you changed it because nobody wanted a German name, right?
Right. I didn't want to be Hirsch. My father didn't want to be Hirsch, so we became Ezrati, which means my help in Hebrew.
Okay. And he sort of botched the spelling transformation, didn't he?
The transliteration should have been E-Z-R-A-T-I, as in Ezra, which means help.
Right.
And he was transliterating it into German, which uses an S as a Z. And so it became E-S-R-A-T-I.
Which is why we're the only ones
right.
like this. So, this, I mean, you had opportunities to go to Palestine, I imagine, right after you got out of the... came back from the army and from Italy, and why didn't you just go then?
It didn't even occur to me. I was not going to do it alone. I was going to do it as part of the movement, and I was, as soon as I got orders, I went.
Okay. So by the time you left in 54, did you already have your master's degree?
Yes.
Okay. And you'd already driven the cab.
Yes.
And there was something...
Now, why did I drive a cab? I got recalled to active duty when the Korean War broke out. I was in the reserves.
That was when?
And that was in 1951, if I remember correctly.
Okay.
Right before I graduated. And so they put me up in Fort Devens, and I found out that I was being investigated and held in pipeline status, and eventually they threw me out. At that point, it became quite clear that Uncle was having problems with my loyalty and security.
So why'd you start driving the cab?
The only job I could get. I tried to get a job, for instance, at a toothbrush factory in Northampton, Massachusetts at one point, and they told me I was overtrained. Another place I tried to get a job, they told me that they had been advised by the Burns Detective Agency that I was a dangerous character and they shouldn't hire me.
All right. So something happened while you were driving a cab that I've always sort of wondered about. And you ended up getting stabbed.
Right.
Why?
I was parked in front of the Latin Quarter nightclub in Boston. And a woman came out and headed for the cab, and I got out of the cab and opened the door for her. And a guy came up behind her, and he was screaming obscenities at her. And I told him to cut it out. And he said, mind your own business. And he stabbed me in the spine. I was taken by a passerby to the Beth Israel Hospital in Boston, where I lay on a gurney all night without anybody ever looking at me. And when morning came, I said, I am a veteran. Please take me to the VA hospital. And the minute I got to the VA, all hell broke loose because they determined that I had been stabbed through the sacrum, that several of my nerves had been damaged or cut, and that surgery was necessary, and I was operated on by the first American black neurosurgeon. Dr. Thomas Matthew.
So, it's not quite the way I thought it was going to turn out, but did they catch the guy who stabbed you?
No.
Nope. Had you already gotten your master's at this point, or you were still working?
Oh, no, I had my master's.
Okay. And your master's was in political science.
Right.
But you, at this point, still had no idea you were going to be going to journalism.
No.
No.
I was expecting to go into the State Department and be a diplomat.
Hmm. So you went to Israel. You met my mother.
Oh, no, no. Long before that, I had found out that career in the state diplomacy was out of the question because I was a suspicious character.
Right.
Then I went to Israel, and I met your mother. She was on the same kibbutz that I was.
So why'd you guys leave?
Where, Israel?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I didn't like it.
Why not?
This
is the place you didn't want to ever leave and the
right.
place you wanted to
well,
go back?
Well, it turned out to be a terrific disappointment. Israel was a country that was living like a beggar. The kibbutz we were on was made up of many Americans, and therefore their families were sending stuff to the kibbutz, including a brand new Caterpillar tractor. And the Caterpillar tractor worked for one day because nobody bothered to put oil in the crankcase.
Oops.
Well, they hadn't paid for it, so what did they care for, you know? On top of that, the religious theocracy practiced in Israel turned me off completely. We were unable to get married in Israel because my father, in his wisdom, had got himself excommunicated in 1935. And when I tell this to people, they say, Jews don't do excommunication. Well, like, believe me, they do.
Hmm.
What happened was my father was upset over the fact that a bunch of Arabs had set fire to the Yemenite quarter of Tel Aviv, where many of his patients lived. And when the fire engines went to the fire, they had to pass the large synagogue on the main drag in Tel Aviv, and people came out of the synagogue, turned over the fire engines, and a lot of people got hurt in the fire. The following week, my father joined a group that trashed the synagogue, and then he went to the rabbinate in Tel Aviv and said, look, I don't want to pay taxes to support your institutions. I want to opt out of the Jewish community. Now, this was legal under the laws that the British had set up for Palestine. But the rabbis instead just threw him out and excommunicated him. Well, when your mother and I tried to get married, we went to the rabbinate in Haifa. They pulled down a volume with my last name initial on it. And they told me I couldn't get married. I should convert.
I'm not even going to. So why'd you come back to the States? My mother's English.
Your mother's English. I wouldn't live in England if you paid me.
Okay.
I dislike England intensely.
So you came back to the States.
Yes.
And this was what year?
1955.
So you weren't there for very long.
No.
You came back to Boston.
Yes.
And, you know, how'd you end up deciding journalism at that point?
Well, I had to get a job, and I walked into the Boston Herald Traveler. Told them I had a master's degree in political science and I wanted to be a reporter. They said, well, we got a job for you in the library. So I went to work at the Herald Traveler in the library for 4 years. And that was my start in journalism.
All right. Somewhere later on in life, I came along and I've always... I've always sensed, you know, that you were very, very political, but not in the traditional sense.
That's correct. I'm very political because After all, Hitler and the British and all these other things that have acted on me are political situations, and so I got attuned that way. My chief interest in college was in political science.
Right.
That makes me a political being.
I was born in 1962 in a small town, Salina. You moved from Boston to Salina.
Right.
And then we moved from Salina to Van Wert, and then from Van Wert to Cleveland. And then you decided to leave the country in 1968.
Yes. Don't you remember why? You came home from play and announced to us that you had just killed 5 gooks in the park.
Yeah.
And I was so upset over the idea that you were killing gooks, as you call them.
But that's what they showed on the nightly news every night, body counts. And
I know.
Okay.
So Canada wasn't involved in the Vietnam War, and I did the honorable thing, and I packed up, and we went to Canada, where I got a job on a newspaper, and everything was almost the same, except for the fact that I had to pay income tax in both countries, and that was hard.
So you wrote a book to me.
Yes.
During this time. What was the purpose of this book?
Well, since you were then living in Canada, and it was probable that you would be there until you were of age, I wanted to steer you as to your choice when you turned 18 and had to pick whether you would be a Canadian or an American. And so Dear Son was my book to you, telling you what was good about America and what was bad about America, and let you decide. It's the best thing I ever wrote.
It's the best thing you ever wrote? What did you expect me to pick after reading that?
I expected you to come back to the States.
Really? So you think this country still has potential, or still had potential then when you wrote it?
Yes.
Do you still think it has potential?
Yes.
You still think it's the land of opportunity?
Yes, unless you're of a particular minority.
Okay. I've reread the book. I still think it's a good book. I still think it's very important. And I think it tells people a lot of the history that we don't get in history class. And it's probably, I didn't need to read it because we came back from Canada in 1971.
Mm-hmm.
And so it really wasn't optional. But I read it when I was 17, and I've read it again.
No, I gave it to you when you were 18.
No, you gave it to me early because I graduated high school, and you gave it to me right about then.
Oh.
Because I graduated young. But who were your heroes? I mean, you wrote about a lot of people in that book and a lot of mm-hmm. stories, but who were your heroes?
You're going to be surprised.
Okay.
My top hero and worshipful object was Ted Williams of the Boston Red Sox.
Okay. Nothing political about that.
No, nothing political at all. My best friend, Johnny Bowles, whose name I use in one of my novels, became one of my heroes when I found out about what happened to him. Johnny was too young for World War II, and he volunteered for the Korean War, became an officer, got terribly shot up, and he refused to be treated at the VA because he said that the VA hurt him more than they helped him. Eventually, Johnny committed suicide because the pain was too much for him.
Something happening with a lot of our veterans still today.
Mm-hmm.
And you found this out.
The way he committed suicide was unbelievably grim. He drowned in an ice bath.
You found this out from his sister-in-law.
From his brother.
From his brother, much later.
Yes, when I published the book.
Yeah. Any other heroes?
Several. Misha Ahrens, who was my commander in the Irgun, and who was later the Israeli ambassador to the United States and the Israeli defense minister several times over. His brother-in-law, Dave Krakow, who lives in New Jersey, was a lawyer in New York. I'll stop right there.
Okay. You've also... And this is something that I struggle with often. There's this, the discussion of Malcolm's way or Martin's way. And you happen to know Martin. You knew him at Boston University when you were working on your master's. But between Malcolm's way or Martin's way, which way do you tend to go?
I'm afraid I go with Malcolm. I remember when Emmett Till was lynched.
Mm-hmm.
There were hundreds of black people all around watching. Not one of them resisted. Not one of them objected. My way of thinking, they should have all had weapons and they should have shot the hell out of the Ku Klux Klanners who did the lynching.
So you're a Second Amendment supporter then?
Oh, yes. You were taught to shoot when you were young for that reason.
But I have a great respect for what you can do with a gun, and I'm very careful about that.
Well, that's to be expected. That's what you're taught to be.
We're supposed to wrap this up. So all of this that you've done and has come together, I mean, I'm your only child. I'm the one to carry it on.
And you have no children or grandchildren.
Nope. So, what do you expect me to do to carry on in your footsteps?
I have no idea. I wish you would get elected, and you keep trying. At the same time, I wish you wouldn't be in politics because your business suffers from your lack of concentration on business. Basically, I'm very proud of you. I thought that the first time you ran for mayor and got rid of the mayor who was in, even though you didn't win, you did a good job.
Almost every time you tell me, I wish you wouldn't do this, and then you support me when I do it. So,
yeah,
it's kind of like expected. So, you think there's hope for the human race at this point? Do you think that?
I don't know. I'm not able to forecast the future. And in our time, so many absolutely horrible things have happened, like the massacre in Srebrenica in Bosnia, the Darfur massacres. I don't even think that most Americans realize what was going on in Darfur. The Sudan is run by Arabs who are white. The southern Sudan is made up of blacks who are animists, who are not Muslim. The white Arabs of the Sudan are eradicating the black animists. It's genocide.
We haven't learned our lessons.
And we never call it genocide. And President Obama, who has said he would intervene, has never done a thing in Darfur.
And that's just one of the places we're having problems.
Well, there are many others. the business with Afghanistan, I should mention it. The British learned a long time ago that nobody can control Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm. The man who would be king.
Among others.
Rudyard Kipling.
Right. And Afghanistan is a place that we got tough about when the Russians moved in. And Jimmy Carter pulled out of the Olympics over it. And it was ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
Let them fight it out. What business was it of ours? Now we were in there, and we can't win.
And it's killing our country.
Yeah.
And it's our time. So any last thoughts?
Nope.
What's your greatest accomplishment?
I've written 3 books, of which I am very proud. Unfortunately, I got ripped off on 2 of them by...
Don't worry, we'll fix that.
Crooks.
E-books will fix that. So, the books?
I'm proud of them, and I'm proud of you. Period.
Good. I'm proud of you, too.
Thank you.